You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the open banking movement. Whether you're a financial expert, banking executive, or everyday consumer, open banking affects everyone and will change the way we interact with our money. I'm A.L. Savan, your host. This episode is brought to you by Ozone API, unlocking the power of open finance all over the world. The United States has enjoyed some form of open banking for decades. However, for most of its history, this uniquely American version of open banking was based on proprietary technologies rather than open standards backed by regulation. The market players who built this early form of open banking came to be called aggregators, tech companies who specialize in letting third parties, typically fintechs, connect to a web of data providers, typically banks, all based on a user's consent. As U.S. open banking matures, it is moving towards the kind of standardization and regulation found in other regions. But unlike other regions, market-driven aggregators will continue to play a central role. In this episode, recorded live in Las Vegas at last year's Money 2020, I sit down with the open banking leads from three major U.S. aggregators, Plaid, MX, and Akoya. Under Section 1033, the freshly minted U.S. open banking regulation, a whole new form of open banking is about to take hold, forever changing how American consumers share their financial data. And the aggregators will be right in the thick of it. For this episode, we're going to try something new. We call it Mr. Open Banking Live. There's a couple of things that will distinguish our live episodes from regular episodes of the show. First, as the name implies, they are recorded live, typically at an industry event. You may hear the din of the crowd or other background noise. Live events might also include, for the first time, more than one guest. The other big difference is in how we handle the conversation itself. On regular episodes, we put a lot of effort into making sure our guests sound perfect. Their speech is cleaned up for clarity and pacing, and soundscapes are used to highlight key points. We also add transitions where I sum up what's been said so far. For our live episodes, we're not doing any of that. Our guests will sound just like they did on the day, with every like, and you know, intact. Well, most of them, anyway. And the episode will run just as long as the original conversation. All in all, the goal is for live episodes to be a lot more raw, to make you feel as if you were in the room where it happened. We sincerely hope you enjoy our first ever episode of Mr. Open Banking Live. You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the evolution of open banking around the world. I'm your host, A.L. Savan, broadcasting live from the Money Pot exhibit at the world's premier fintech event, Money 2020. For this session, I am joined by three guests who are all at the very center of open banking here in the United States and have been there since its early days. Each of them are responsible for driving the open banking strategy at a major U.S. aggregator, the firms that power the most active data sharing ecosystem in the world. John Pitts is the head of global policy at Plaid. Jane Barrett is the chief advocacy officer at MX, and Anil Mahalaha is the chief evangelist at Akoya. Let's jump right in. The three of you lead the open banking efforts at some of the largest aggregators in the United States. why don't you take a moment to tell us a little bit about each of your organizations and perhaps what makes them different from each other?
Well, I'm happy to go first, and I'm going to start out with just an immediate pushback. I know the title of this is Meet the Aggregators, but I think we do need a degree of precision around what our respective companies do, and especially in light of a lot of the potential regulation that is going down. Aggregation is often seen as the collection, the assembly, and then the sale of data. Our companies do not do that. So you need to think of us as more intermediaries that are consumer permissioned. So in the MX case, that's getting to the question that you asked, we have been around 14 plus years now. We work with mostly banks and credit unions, some fintechs, and we enable both the connectivity of data, so people accessing their data and sharing their data. We enhance that data. A big part of our business is actually bringing a layer of intelligence and clarity to machine-readable data and turning it into human-readable form. And then we have a whole suite of digital money management tools, everything from white label mobile apps, digital like basic budgeting, net worth tracking, all of the things that people do with their money. So under the glass for consumers, and then also insights and analytics tools for the businesses that serve them. So we really look at our service offering as an end-to-end. The data powers the enhancement, powers the tools. And I think from a just how the ecosystem plays out in terms of where we sit, there are, if you think of one axis of permission data versus non-permission data and another axis of high-risk use cases, low-risk use cases, we definitely sit in the lower of the risk use cases and always consumer permission data. We are not doing credit scoring. We are not doing payment money movement. So I think just bringing that degree of clarity to how the ecosystem is laid out right now is really important.
And so now I'll talk about Plaid. I would say the first observation I have is that we are much worse at titles than MX and Clear, right? Like
you head of
global head of policy, like chief advocate, right? Chief evangelist. Man, I gotta go talk to Zach about something. Like that's, I think that's really the critical distinction. No, more seriously, we're the largest data network in North America. One in three consumers is using Plaid to connect their financial data from wherever they're holding it to wherever they want to send it to get a product or service they want. We cover an incredibly broad array of products. Some of it is the basics of just that pure data connectivity and consumer permissioning. But we do credit reporting. We have a CRA. We do pay by bank use cases. We're doing a lot these days on anti-fraud in particular. Would love to talk about that a little bit more as we get going, because I think that's one of the really exciting areas coming out of this last week, where if you can't already tell from the excitement of my voice, this is a big week at Money 2020 because Director Chopra was here last night. He announced last week the final 1033 rule. So Plaid has been building this open banking, open finance world in the US, Canada, and Europe for the last 10 years. And now we have the regulatory structure around it that's going to make it grow even more quickly.
Akoya is the new kid on the block. We have a data access network that provides financial institution data to third parties. So you connect to the data access network once as a third party and you get data from any of the financial institutions that are connected to it. So that's one of the things. The other thing is Akoya is only an API access data. Akoya does not scrape the data from the third parties. Now I know with the new ruling, everybody has to stand up API, so that will over time go away. But Akoya, being the new kid, has never scraped the data, does not store the data, and it's a pass-through only network. So we don't have the data, we don't monetize on the data. We take the data, we give it to the third party that needs the data. As far as decorating the data is concerned, if needed, Akoya can decorate the data, but for the most part, we're a pass-through network. And then we also have a new product that we launched recently, the 1033 compliance solution. So we work with banks to get them compliant with the 1033 regulation that came out, the final one that came out last week.
As all of you have mentioned, something very special has happened in the U.S. this past week. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, officially released their final open banking rule under the name Personal Financial Data Rights, based on Section 1033 of the Dodd-Frank Act. Why don't each of you give me your two-line version of what this rule says?
First, I'd like to apologize for all the listeners who are listening on double speed that now me and John and Anil are four speed for your two speed. So it's going to get a little tricky for me. So two lines. People have the right to access and share their data, and their data can't be used for more than the use case of their permission for it.
I don't know that it actually makes sense to try and give a different definition than that, because that is what this rule does. I will add some decoration to it. I've never decorated data in my life, but I will decorate Jane's statement with it also gives consumers control over that right with better authorization, a recurring ability to reauthorize their data, and to understand how their data is going to be used when they share it with a third party.
So I'd say that it's still early days, still trying to digest the rule, but I think it's a transformative. Open banking itself is really transformative in the United States. It is making a financial environment more equitable for the consumers. That's really what it is about. It is enabling the consumers to fully participate in the digital economy. It is giving them more tools to have a better financial health and to participate more, like I said, and also gives small businesses more products and services, especially for those who do not have a banking relationship.
The CFPB's personal financial data rights rule is now official, but was it even necessary? You have all been active members of the Financial Data Exchange, or FDX, a member-driven, private, nonprofit standards body that has managed to grow to 94 million records shared without any regulation. Was a market-driven approach enough? And if not, why not?
So I think it's actually really important to recognize that FDX and the data providers that are members of FDX, in my opinion, would not have made that progress without knowing that regulation was coming. There was very little API adoption or API momentum 10 years ago. There was some 5 years ago. That 5 year ago mark was also when the CFPB started doing RFIs about a 1033 rule. The CFPB has progressively gone from RFI to a SBRIFA. I'm going to use terminology that's terrible here, so just apologies for everyone, to a SBRIFA small business review, to a notice of proposed rulemaking, to this final rule. Every step they have taken, the number of APIs in market has gone up, and this final rule is going to drive the rest of the market to APIs, as Anil mentioned. So I actually don't think that they're on its own without knowing that there was regulation coming.
Yeah, and I think we've made enormous progress. Like, again, we could all join the United Nations after this because, like, fierce competitors also having to work together every day. Like, I think I see John more than many people at NX, frankly. But having an interoperable standard, and we see Jason Hendry out here, who we consider Jason and Neil like godfathers of the actual spec, has gone a really, really long way to solving for how does data get exchanged. But it doesn't solve for everything. Like, we still do need regulatory backstop around things like liability sharing, which, frankly, I don't think many countries have solved properly. Like, who can get access to this data? What are some of the requirements? What are the data usage rights? Things that have been baked into bilateral agreements for data sharing now haven't necessarily been shared through an FDX standard because it's much more of a technology standard. So having again, the thought that regulation is coming and we need to move ahead of it, we have thousands of financial institutions as clients. I feel like I've talked to all of them. And my number one message is this is a competitive carrot versus a regulatory stick. If you're waiting for the regulatory stick, you're already too late because the customer experience is so much better with these APIs that if you're only doing it to comply with regulation, you've already missed the boat.
I think the market-driven approach was working, has been working this long, right? The rule dropped last week, but like John said, it has been in the from the SBRIFA, from the principles that they rolled out a long time ago, from the NPRM to the 294 pages that dropped last week. I think the market approach had been working. I think what the ruling does is provides a framework for enforcement, but I think, like you said, 94 million accounts were already on this. But I do agree that the threat of the rulemaking definitely expedited the market partnerships.
Open banking is now active in over 70 countries. But one of the things that makes the CFPB's rule unique, and indeed FDX unique, relative to other regulations and standards around the world, is
They include a special role for data aggregators, like yourselves. What exactly is this role, and why was it necessary for the U.S. to explicitly include this role when other regions didn't?
I mean, the U.S. has the most complicated financial landscape of any country on Earth. Right. If you go to any banker here and say, do you want to do a direct connection with over 10,000 covered financial institutions and over 10,000 fintechs and go do compliance on all of them? Good luck with that, right? So, you know, at some point, there may be a solution that is a lot more fluid. But for now, like, groups like ours have invested years and millions of dollars building up a network that works. And it is very hard to say, okay, we're going to put 100 million users back in the bottle and like go with some other standard or some other way of working. Because as Anil said, data has been flowing, things are moving, but it is just so enormously complex.
Yeah, and just building on that, the sort of quiet secret of that 94 million number that you cited before, Al, is that that is actually just a handful of FIs that that represents. And it's because on this complex landscape, we have a couple of very large financial institutions with an immense amount of market power and market percentage. And so when they move over to API, a lot of accounts move over to API. But you also have thousands of community banks and credit unions. Actually, they're some of the ones who are most eager to get onto API. We've done a huge amount to support them. We've now got 2,500 small community bank credit unions on APIs through partnerships because they want their customers to have a better data access and data sharing experience. They want their customers to be able to use the most popular apps. And so that transition takes quite a bit of work. And the rest of the market needs to get there as well. And that is where I think this U.S. approach of needing data aggregators to cover the complexity of that market really does separate it out from other markets. Though in those other markets, data aggregators are common as well.
Yeah. And I mean, Director Chopra has been very clear that competition is baked into this rule. And like in no point in the U.S. financial system is there a single point of failure, right? You do need to spread the risk, spread the innovation, and make sure that there isn't that one player saying we are the answer for how data gets shared in the U.S.
I think we talked about market-driven, right? So this was market-driven for so long. I think it's just the recognition of what the market is. There are data aggregators in the market. This is the biggest open banking market. We have been around for a while, some more than others. So it's just a recognition of what the market is. But at the end of the day, the responsibility, the obligation still lies with the third party, right? I mean, they can delegate it to a data aggregator to get the data. But as far as authorization is concerned, they can also do the authorization. They would have to certify that they are in the middle. But the third party responsibility still lies with the third party.
Jane, you mentioned that competition is at the heart of this new rule. Director Chopra has made it very clear that he prizes healthy competition above all else and is very keen on redressing anti-competitive behavior. In the rule, he says the goal is to create, quote, an open system not dominated by the interests of any one segment of the market, end quote. Are aggregators one of those segments?
I can go first, but I think it's not just the aggregators. It's any big third party. It's any big service provider. It's any big aggregator, any big bank, everybody who's playing a role in the ecosystem. I think that's what I'm not looking at it as just aggregators, but any dominant player in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is pretty fierce competition among aggregators. I think one of the things that the director is concerned about is the history of in financial services, large banks creating consortia that they own and control and using that as a sole provider. And I think there's concern that the data access market could end up in the same place where a bank-owned utility not only controls everything, but also starts setting rules of the road that affect competitors for those banks. And I think the director's been very clear that the rule prevents that and that that's a key part of it. We're also going to be competing in the aggregation space with companies that, once APIs are in place, want to directly connect. And I think that's always going to be a critical competition. If we're not adding value to that, then, you know, the customers will go directly to the banks and that will be the right way for open banking to work. So it's a goad to us to make sure we're always delivering the best service.
John, you snuck in the term bank-owned utility. For those who don't know, Akoya is indeed bank-owned. Plaid, however, is, by your own description, the dominant aggregator. What difference does it make whether the market is being held hostage by a bank-owned utility or by a non-bank-owned aggregator?
I think the key difference is, does a data recipient have a choice of who they use to get access to a consumer's data when the consumer is permissioning them? Today, lots of third parties have a real choice in the market. I lose customers to Jane. Jane loses customers to me. And we fight each other fiercely for the right to provide those customers the best service. And that's what a healthy market looks like.
Yeah. I mean, we can throw this question back to you, AL. Like, Canada, right? There isn't a robust, let's say, ecosystem of intermediaries who have enabled access. We have, you know, a much less complex bank ecosystem that is dominated by, what, 5-6 big players, and the consumers are the ones who are losing out, right? The fintech ecosystem in Canada is positively anemic, if not slash bled out, versus the ecosystem here in the US, because data has been flowing for 20 years now. I'm going to get you to defend Canada. That was a question.
For the regular listeners of the show, I add my stuff later, but I'm happy to discuss that with you in private. Anil, do you have anything to add?
No, nothing really. I mean, it's the rule dropped last week, right? And it's leveled the playing field. So I don't understand, you know, how, at least help me understand if you all can, like, how is it that some utility can do that? Like, the role of the service provider is baked in the role. But you're a service provider, you're providing services to the bank, like all of us are, and any of the aggregators or third parties can come and get the data. So I fail to understand, and maybe we can...
Oh, no, I actually agree with you, Anil. I think that's one of the questions that Ayal asked in the beginning was, why does the rule matter? Why can't it just be private? And that guarantee of leveling the playing field, I think, is one of the important aspects of the rule and guarantees that we're going to have thriving competition in this market. So it's one of the reasons I think the rule is critical. It's good to hear you say that.
Right,
so,
and I think these questions were put together before the rule dropped.
Yeah.
So landscape has changed now.
Oh, there might be a couple of surprising ones on the way. But let's go with one that I think perhaps you saw coming. In the U.S., as Jane mentioned, data sharing through aggregators has been around for over 20 years. Although they have long served a real and crucial consumer need, there are two aspects of how they have worked that are likely to change under the new rule: screen scraping and bilateral agreements. Will either of these practices come to an end, and should they come to an end?
Well, I mean, from a screen scraping perspective, the covered data in the rule is actually pretty narrow, right? It's just core retail, checking, savings, credit card, digital wallets, right? So your mortgage isn't in there, your car loan isn't in there, your investment isn't in there, your retirement accounts. Like, there's a lot of elements that are not provided under the rule. However, many of the APIs that have been stood up already, and frankly, the FDX spec, is much broader than what's in the covered role. So we have all, and I will say all, have been very committed to moving away from screen scraping because APIs are better. Like, there is much better technology. There isn't some need to hold on to screen scraping. Like, why would we want the risk of credential sharing and a crappy customer experience that breaks? So having this move away from screen scraping, I think, is universally shared. At the same time, should these rules be weaponized and say, you know what, we're not going to share anything but what is covered in the rule? I mean, a core part of the MX value proposition is a 360-degree view of your finances, right? Are we going to go to tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people and say, oh, sorry, you can't have that anymore, right? It is not good customer experience or, frankly, good just service aspect to move away. So one was the screen scraping. We're aligned on moving away from that. I think the bilateral agreements, again, they were many years to get in place. They go much, much broader than either the rule or what is covered in the SSO through FDX, through just the standard FDX spec. So there's things we still need to solve as an ecosystem to enable this next tranche of data providers to be able to, frankly, and intermediaries and recipients, to be able to participate. And so I think that is something that as FDX we take seriously. It's certainly something in MX we take seriously, of just how can we do more shared learnings out there, best practices to accelerate that. We shouldn't be negotiating bilateral agreements for a year plus. Like, and that's how it was in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I think Akoya was stood on the principle of no screen scraping, right? I think we all agree that screen scraping is bad. I think Jane alluded to that. I think CFPB talks about it multiple times.
But does not outright forbid it.
Because there are certain use cases in the industry that in order to provide your data from small banks, you have to do that, right? So I think CFPB has outlined that in the rulemaking about a need for screen scraping, but I don't think that they are, you know, championing screen scraping in wholesale, right? I think that we all know about the downsides of screen scraping. Credentials are out there. Data minimization is not possible. There's multiple issues with screen scraping, and I think we all agree, it's preaching to the choir here, the screen scraping is bad. But as the implementation time gets to all of the banks, over a period of time, screen scraping will go away. As far as bilateral is concerned, I agree. I think what the CFPB rulemaking does talk about is that it'll hopefully reduce the negotiation and the back and forth between the two parties in the bilateral agreement, and it'll bring it down so that it's not as painful.
Yeah, and I will just say, because I can't add much to what Jane and Anil already said, you really covered it. I view this market as a three-legged stool, where you have bilateral agreements, especially with the largest institutions. You have a standard-setting organization, ideally FDX, that is setting standard interoperable rules for data access at a technical level. And you have a regulation that provides a guarantee and certainty for everyone participating. That three-legged stool, I see a permanent future state, and I don't see a world where there aren't data access agreements covering part of that market.
Another aspect addressed by the new regulation is secondary use. In the final version of the rule, the CFPB doubled down on their position that broad secondary use is unacceptable unless it helps serve the customer. In fact, Director Chopra has even talked about surveillance pricing when speaking of how data is misused in this context. What are your positions on secondary use?
I mean, I'm happy to go first. It was good to see that the final rule did actually expand a little from the proposed rule in terms of secondary data, meaning like someone has permissioned their data to be used for a certain use case, and then there is a different use case that you want to use it for. And one of the, I think we're all very aligned as an industry, is that secondary de-identified data is used for things like platform stability, fraud monitoring, things that are absolutely in the service of a use case, but not the direct use case. And so the definition moved an inch, not a mile. I think we do applaud the CFPB in terms of this is probably the biggest step towards a federal privacy just out of any industry. So it's incredibly ambitious to be putting this out there in the absence of a federal privacy law. But then the other side of it is data has been used as for marketing, for segmentation, for just normal course of business things, that now there will be additional friction put into a customer experience in the terms of secondary consent, right? I consent to my data being shared to flow into my budgeting app, and now I have to do secondary consent for cross-marketing, for is there a better product for me? So you could argue if someone has said, I want help with a budgeting app, like showing them a better product at a better interest rate should be in service of this is going to help you meet your budget better. But the way that the rule reads is that it would require secondary data. Again, we're all still digesting, but that adding a friction point, again, it's incredibly ambitious to say we're going to put a box around data given just the data economy is huge, the way the data is used across industries. And again, huge credit to the CFPB for even trying to put their arms around this. We'd love to see the conversation opened up to ad tech, to big tech players, the ones who have actually built trillion-dollar businesses based on our data.
So that is actually the one thing that concerns me. Jane already covered really what's in the rule. The one thing that really concerns me, though, is because this
privacy rule only affects part of the market, there's a risk of an unlevel playing field where some players can do something with a consumer's data that others can't. And that can be really confusing to consumers. It also can create market distortions that are problematic for competition. Just for example, earlier this year, JPMC launched Chase Media Services, right? That is using financial data for advertising purposes. They can do that with data that they have. They couldn't do that with data they got from 1033. It also means a competitor of theirs couldn't do it with data, even if the consumer voluntarily shares it. So I actually like some of the privacy provisions in this rule. I think they are a real step forward for consumers. I would really like to see a level playing field across the financial services industry where if this is a good rule on privacy for consumers, it should apply to everyone in every circumstance and not just to some participants in the markets and some data, but not other participants.
Yeah, so Akoya doesn't have the data, so that we have no secondary use of the data. But in general, I think, like you said, the rule has narrowed the definition of it. I think the data is the consumer's data, as we all agree, and it should be used for the benefit of the consumer to provide products and service to the consumer. But I don't think we have heard the end of it from CFPB on the secondary use. I think Chirpa talked about circling back on the secondary use, so we'll see how that turns out.
In other markets, the introduction of shared standards for open banking and the requirement that data providers provide APIs that meet that standard has turned connectivity into something of a commodity, driving the cost of aggregation way down. Nevertheless, aggregators in other markets such as TrueLayer and Tink have thrived. How do you think the U.S. aggregation market will be affected by the introduction of CFPB's rule?
Oh man, I am so excited about that question because, like, to me, the pipes are the necessary underpinning of the market, but they're not the exciting thing, right? Like, our customers are not really excited about that because it's basically a solved problem. Where they are really excited are the use cases that this unlocks, that are the value-added use cases on top of it. So let me go through three really quickly that I think are the most exciting, that we're investing the most resources on. The first is cash flow underwriting, right? The ability of any consumer to reliably share their data in order to get access to credit. We have 40 million credit invisible consumers in this country who cannot get access to credit through a traditional credit score. And being able to let them do what every small business does in this country and say, here is my cash flow information, make me a loan on the basis of 2 years of transaction history, is amazing. And you can only do that when you have reliable access everywhere, but that's not access, that's the value add on top of the access. The next one that I think is incredibly exciting is the emergence of pay by bank. If you look at the director's remarks, pay by bank is all over this. Consumers are still paying with checks in a lot of places. Bill pay is something that is driven by consumers, like literally reading an account number over the phone to someone in order to set up a direct connection. It is a terrible, janky process, and moving that market over to a easy digital way of paying directly from your bank and paying with something that is less expensive than a credit or debit card, I think is an enormous opportunity. The final one is anti-fraud, as I said earlier, where we have in this country a growing problem with fraud. It's a problem the banks are wrestling with. It's a problem the banks are wrestling with their own service, Zelle, right? And right now you've got some fraud sharing. EWS, Early Warning Services, that's the seven largest banks, they can share fraud information with each other. That leaves another 10,000 banks that can't share fraud data and another 20,000 fintechs that can't share fraud data. And that just doesn't reflect how consumers behave these days. Consumers have multiple bank accounts and multiple apps. And if you're going to protect that consumer, you need networks that can share fraud information and fraud signals across all of those endpoints that affect the consumer's life. Plaid is pushing that out with both our Layer product and our Beacon product. I think those are some of the really exciting value-add services that this enables and that will become the core of what a lot of data networks do on top of this 1033 rule.
Yeah, for sure. I think I agree. I mean, it's the value-add service that is the differentiator, like any other market, open banking market around the world, right? Getting the data is a commodity. It will become a commodity. There's nothing to it. But it's the value-add service that John talked about that is the differentiator.
And it's also, it isn't apples to apples. I think many of the markets that you're referring to, They have registries. They have certification programs. They have the good housekeeping seal of approval by the government to operate in the marketplace. And right now, intermediaries are playing that role. We have to do due diligence on our customers in order for them to receive data. We have to do pass-through obligations in contractual terms. We have to assign liability in case of breach. Like, there is a lot that is being done by the intermediary layer that I think is underappreciated from a complexity perspective and a responsibility perspective. And we're also seeing the market get a lot smarter. Like in the early days of MX, we would bring in data from multiple sources and we had technology that would switch to the best, most secure, fastest source of data. We're seeing customers do that now, right? They might work with all of us and they're switching real time between. So there is still a very healthy competition and very much a need for such a complex marketplace to be organized in a way that isn't, again, single point of failure.
Let me double click on that for a minute. Anil, you said that despite all of the excellent use cases that John described, connectivity will in fact become commoditized. In the European market, you saw smaller aggregators like Nordigen show up and offer essentially free aggregation services. Do you expect that same kind of market dynamic to happen in the US?
Free?
Nordigen was free, technically freemium.
No, I think it'll be a commodity, is all I can say. You'll see how this goes. But it'll be a commodity business where you're calling somebody's API, you're taking the data, you're converting into the standard format, FTX, right? And you're providing the data. It's not rocket science. Anybody can do that. Yes, you have to scale to the 16,000, and not really 16,000, like maybe 200, 300 banks, and then the core processors. So yes, it will be a commodity. But I think everything that John talked about, those use cases that Jane talked about, right, that's really where is the differentiator. That's really where the value-add service is.
Jane, you mentioned registries and certification in the U.S. market. Those are still somewhat gray at best. Where do you think this tricky question of accreditation, certification, and a central directory or registry of accredited participants is headed in the U.S.?
Well, I think the CFPB was very clear that this is not their role, right? They are looking to industry to solve this.
So that was Jane's shortest answer.
I know,
so
right?
I think she's maybe looking for someone who more loquacious to jump in, so I will happily do that. So a couple of things there that are baked into that question. Where does oversight of participants sit? Actually, like, oversight of participants sits with Jordi Cohen and the amazing products that she's building at Plaid to register our customers, make sure they're meeting their compliance obligations, share that information with banks, and make sure the banks have everything they need to quickly onboard an app and know that it is meeting its compliance deadline. So everyone should go talk to Jordi if they want to know how that's going to work. For the other questions about, like, the standard setting, I mean, we're all in FDX. I think we expect that to be the place that is going to happen. And the CFPB has clearly carved out the lane for private industry to do it. I think it's one of the most exciting parts of this rule is the CFPB giving the opportunity to private industry to move at the pace private industry can to continue to drive innovation. Some of those other markets you've seen, you really do have just like a single standard created not by industry, but by government. And I think it has really slowed down innovation in some of those markets because those standards are not fit for purpose for what the consumer wants and what businesses need to deliver to them.
Yeah.
For the purpose of accreditation, certification, FDX has certainly been discussing playing that role, less so for a registry or directory, although they have something that is a de facto solution now. It is not the kind of trust framework that you see implemented in other regions. Is there an opportunity for aggregators to step in and play that role, potentially in some sort of distributed or federated manner?
I mean, that's what we've been doing. Like, this is exactly the business, and this is not new, AL. This is 10 years in. So we have a lot of experience of ensuring that our customers are, you know, not breaking the law, that they're compliant with the sort of obligations that we have to uphold. So, yeah, I don't think, and I think this is a meta comment for just open banking generally, for anyone that thinks that 1033 was a kickoff or a starting gun, it was not. Like, this has been moving for a very long time. There is a lot of progress. It's very hard to put a genie back into a bottle and say, oh, we're going to do something different now. Or can everyone go and adhere to a different standard or go through a long process that other countries may be contemplating for just to be able to receive data? And again, I think the CFPB has done a really good job of getting their arms around, like, this is an ongoing thing that they're not trying to stop or redirect, but definitely trying to make more precise and more equitable and more competitive.
No, I was just going to say, I think there's a difference between accreditation and certification. I think FTX is going to be an SSO, if that, right? Not an SRO. SRO would do the accreditation. So I think it is certification, it's voluntary certification that just proves that you're up to the standards that have been published.
And that is just on the FTX certification. We did a lot of work in FTX and we're still doing work on that certification. What's really clear in the market is the value of that certification is tied to the regulation, where if you don't have the regulation that you are certifying someone to, even if it's just to the scope of data or the format of the data, that really isn't there. And so what I wouldn't want to see is a market where you don't have that kind of certification, because then you start losing interoperability. All of the things that we're working for to make this better for everyone, really that does ultimately tie back to having this regulation in place and then being able to make sure everyone's meeting their obligations under it.
If you've all been working towards coordinating your efforts around building a trust into the ecosystem, can you elaborate on the mechanics of how that's done?
How do you mean?
I spoke earlier about this idea of distributed or federated approaches to, let's say, checking each other's directories of participants. Does that actually happen from a technical or programmatic perspective, where Plaid systems are talking to MX systems and Plaid and MX systems are talking to Akoya systems and essentially sharing information, sharing lists, so that you're all looking at the same song sheet?
So it feels a little anti-competitive, but it's talking to be sharing our customers. Is that what you're asking?
I'm thinking more of, well, centralized but federated. So providing that kind of facility in a way that is not anti-competitive and would allow other participants to join that, but it's done based on a transparent, open standard for the purpose of providing trust.
So let me give a try at that. I think it's going to be a partial answer at best, but I'm still trying to grope to the vision that you're laying out there. One of the requirements in the rule is that every participant have a legal entity identifier number, an LEI number. Now, whether someone is using MX or using Plaid, they're going to need that LEI number. That LEI number doesn't change if they switch providers. The data provider needs to have a record of that LEI number. That's actually one of the things where Plaid has made a bunch of investments over the last year, is making sure that process of sharing that critical recipient information back with the provider having the clear record of it, and making sure that that is known in the system. That takes a lot of work, and we've done the work to get that done. So I don't know that that's quite the full vision that you've got, but it is going to be a critical piece of it, where having that unique identifier for every participant will let you know who's there. And the CFPB has talked about that being a critical way of redressing any consumer harm that might happen, so you can track where the data has gone, who was responsible for it, and make sure that the consumer is protected.
Yeah, and I think it's such a core part of the ecosystem. I know we've built out a platform called Data Access that is, it belongs to a data provider. We have to code up to Data Access the way that Plaid or anyone else needs to. And fundamental to that is somewhat automating, but just the registration of who the data recipients are and attaching all of the unique identifiers to that. Now, taking it that one step further of like, how does that go back into some sort of federated database? Like, I don't even know if the data providers would be okay with that at this point. Like, we have solved for a lot of things, but the US especially really is built on this idea of competition and innovation alongside consumer protection and privacy. And I think sometimes it's like you swing so far to protection and privacy that innovation goes away. And I think, again, the CFPB has done a great job of threading that needle.
I agree with everything Jane and John said. The only thing I would add to it is that so far it has been a market-led approach, and we will see where the market takes it.
On the subject of the market, let's return to this question of commercializing data sharing. The regulation is quite clear that data providers cannot charge for data access, similar to what many other regions have done. Consumers, they say, should be able to share their financial data for free. But aggregators effectively charge third parties for access to data. So why does it matter where the toll is paid?
Well, I think that's a critical question. And I spoke to it a little bit earlier, but let me expand out a little bit, Al, because this is where the value add that Jane provides, that we provide at Plaid, is critical. Under this rule, any recipient can go directly to the bank and get the data for free. So if someone who's operating a network is not adding value, they won't get used. The value is not the data itself. It is the service that you are providing, and that is not paying for data. It is paying for that service. And I think that's a critical way to understand the market. I'm actually a little bit confused by the objection to some people get to charge, but we would like to charge just for the consumer to get access for their data. There's a difference between the data access and the value-added service.
And I think commercializing is a good way to frame this, because it's not like zero versus money, right? There is a cost to scraping. There is a cost to maintaining systems. And frankly, yes, you invest in standing up an API, but after that initial investment, like, the management really does fall off, right? So yes, you've made an investment, but now you're saving money in many other places. And like, again, like from an MX value prop perspective, one of our core values is when you get insight into data from an enhancement perspective, right, you haven't just made the data available. Now you can actually see in your transaction, in human readable form, a logo, a company name, a URL, a location, right? Guess what that does? That has like calls to call centers fall off a cliff, right? Because someone isn't looking at this stupid paper printout of machine readable transaction history and say, I don't know what SBX-175. And it was like, oh, that was Starbucks Las Vegas, right? Right. So it isn't just very binary. There are absolute flow-on effects for investing in these sort of value-add services. And I think it needs to also be shared that, I know Plaid has been investing for a long time too. We invest millions in setting up the ability to connect and share this data. This isn't some big money grab. Like, this is a, we have to invest in making the connections. We have to invest in our platform. We have to invest in privacy and security and all of the things that is not free. Like, it's not, oh, you can just plug in easy. These take years in terms of bilateral agreements and then the actual coding and then deleting of any old data that may not have been permissioned in the new form. Like, there is a lot of work to do still.
Yeah, I think as far as paying for value-added service that Jen is saying, obviously you're spending a lot of money, so you should be able to charge. Before Akoya, before we founded Akoya, I was part of Fidelity Investments. And at Fidelity Investments, we stood up the Fidelity Access APIs, right? And I was leading that effort. And it took millions of dollars to stand up the infrastructure, which was very different from Fid.com, Fidelity.com, right? So this was a brand new infrastructure we had to stand up, new servers, in the data centers. So it does cost money. It's not free. The infrastructure costs money and the standards change over a period of time. So you have to keep up with the standards. And then it's the sheer cost of the employees who are managing those services on a daily basis need to be paid. So there's no mystery here that, yeah, it costs money to have these services up and running. So you should be able to charge for the value you're providing. Is all I can say.
In a single sentence, should access to the data be something you can charge for?
I mean, no.
No.
Yeah. And we can hear a bank-owned company say yes.
But it's bank, yeah. I mean, I think the banks fund every company up here, right? It's not just Koya. There's millions of dollars being invested in other companies also. I said, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not in a bank anymore, so I don't know. So I cannot answer that question from a bank point of view.
I think it is antithetical to the progress of technology, right? When you think of what we collectively do as a digital ecosystem is I don't stand in line at a bank branch anymore. That's awesome, right? Guess what? Banks are now scaling back on their bank branches and all of the associated costs with real estate and tellers and all of those things. So again, it's not a binary, if we can or can't charge for one thing. People, this is your bank now, right? And I think having access to data and enabling people to do what they need to do is a heavy infrastructure investment, and data sharing is just one piece of that.
For those listening, Jane was holding up her phone when she said this because it doesn't translate to an audio format all the time.
This. It's the water bottle.
On that subject, just yesterday on stage here at Money 2020, Director Chopra discussed a lawsuit that was filed against the CFPB by the Kentucky Bankers Association, challenging the regulation one day after it arrived. Many of the banks behind the lawsuit are the very same banks who sit on the board of FDX, where, Jane, you are going to be co-chair. Your thoughts on what is largely perceived as a conflict?
Again, I think the Chevron doctrine was passed, 6 months ago or so, and that immediately opened up a hashtag, there will be lawsuits. So this was not unexpected. We have achieved a lot as an industry working together. Speaking from an Amex perspective, I think incredibly proud of the collaboration that's happened today, incredibly happy with the data that is flowing. But to John's earlier point, the data is from a handful of larger banks. So moving forward, right, John said it's a three-legged stool, and it absolutely is a three-legged stool, that regulation plays an important role to fill the gray areas outside of bilateral agreements for a scalable ecosystem. So again, purely from an MX perspective, we do hope that the industry can keep on collaborating and solving issues.
And listen, this is America. It's Sue SA. There's going to be litigation over everything. If the temperature is slightly the wrong in your hotel room, you're probably going to sue. But the litigation is going to play out however it's going to play out. The thing that's important is I've talked to a number of banks, both large and small, over the last 5 days. All of them, even with the extended timelines for compliance, are focused on one thing from a business perspective, which is we still need these APIs in place. We still need the good consumer protections at the consents in place. We need all of the things that the rule says are necessary. We need to start building them now. And so that has been the consistent message that I have heard. It is where Plaid is dedicating its resources, is to making sure that every consumer gets the full protections of the rule and the full protections of data access.
And crucially, they want those things, whether the regulation forces them to have them or not.
I mean, that is what the consumer demand is, and folks who are not meeting that demand are going to be left behind as consumers move to the digital experiences they want.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you about the litigation and any of those, but I can tell you that we've been working together. The three of us have been working together for years, and we will continue to work together for the better of the consumer.
Let's project into the future. The CFPB picks a standard, let's say FDX. U.S. financial institutions and third parties adopt open banking, and consumers now have the ability to securely share their financial data with whomever they please. What happens next? Will U.S. consumers embrace open banking or ignore it? And will the CFPB extend their mandate even further?
So I think the CFPB has been very clear that this is the first of multiple rulemakings. Again, to my point earlier, this is pretty narrow in scope. So we do expect follow-on rulemaking to cover lending use cases, investment use cases, retirement accounts. Like the, we expect this to continue to go. But to your first point, I think it is moot to say, will U.S. consumers embrace open banking? They have. They have for a decade already, right? It's just been through different forms. So will U.S. consumers use tokenized APIs? Yeah. They don't. Do they need to know it's a tokenized API? No. Right? This is just, it's better technology to enable the experiences that they want to see. So, yeah, it is a moot point about customer adoption. We have an incredibly robust financial ecosystem in terms of, and I mean, just look out on the floor here. Right? We're here at Money 2020. There are businesses and use cases that cover the gamut of consumer and small business and commercial banking, and I would say the vast majority of them rely now on data. Like it's already happened, right? And it, in terms of further rulemaking, it is more about just clarifying the how, the what's covered. I fully expect the industry to continue to move ahead of rulemaking and continue to innovate.
Yeah, I agree. I was smiling when you were asking the question. I think the train has already left the station. Right, it's here, it's staying, it's not going away, open banking, right? I think it'll get expanded more. I think Chopra has talked about retirement accounts, investment accounts, mortgage accounts, payroll, commercial accounts in the coming small and medium business accounts. So I think it's just going to grow and expand.
And I just want to really emphasize what I think is the most important part of your question, which is, what does this mean for the consumer 5 years from now? Because that is why we are here, is for the consumer. Today, even though we have had a lot of open banking adoption, if you look at the bank that is paying the least amount on deposits, it's around 0.1% annual interest. If you look at the bank that is paying the most, it's closer to 5%. Like that is, ask any economist, should that exist? And they will tell you no, right? Those prices should converge on some market clearing price. And the difference for the consumer, if you are at that 0.01% FI, you are missing out on hundreds or thousands of dollars a year that should be in your pocket in a more competitive market. Similarly, for access to credit, there are consumers that are paying more in interest when they take out a loan than they should because their credit history is not an accurate reflection of their financial ability today. And cash flow underwriting gives you a real-time snapshot of that consumer today, not that consumer 7 years ago. So the opportunity for consumers to have lower interest rates when they are borrowing money and time tens of thousands of dollars 5 years from now as we get this even more robust.
Anil, you mentioned the train has left the station, that the U.S. has largely already moved beyond open banking into what some call open finance, but the train has not quite arrived at open data. In many of Director Chopra's statements, he includes allusions to big tech, who hold data that is well beyond financial services. Is the U.S. going to move towards a generalized personal data right?
You've got to ask someone smarter than me for that. I mean, like, that's such a big question. It's not a CFPB question. That is ultimately a question for Congress and the president. And here, as we sit here a few days before Election Day, I don't think any of us could prognosticate with any reliability as to how that might happen.
Yeah. And as the Australian in the room who did pass, again, I have not been in Australia for a long time, but Australia was very ambitious with assigning a legal ownership right over data with their personal data, CDR, the consumer data right. And that has been in place now for 4 or 5 years. It has had some success, but limited because, like many things, it got politicized. It became a partisan issue, which I think just calling out again ahead of the election, the fact that open banking has been so spectacularly bipartisan here is just, again, testament to the CFPB, the intent, the thoughtfulness of how this has been approached, because you can't name many substantive issues that have such bipartisan support. So will the US go to a consumer data right, like a legal ownership right? I think we are at the legal access right, which is a huge step forward. But to the bigger big tech question, and to my earlier point, this is the first sort of salvo around how do we start to limit data exhaust? And we haven't used that term here. I think health data, financial data are the two most important sources of personal financial data. IFA does a good job at least keeping a lid on health data. Having 1033 as the first, like putting a box around your financial data and have less of it out there is a really good thing for the world.
What did John say?
That's actually how most FDX meetings go. It's just that
they do.
To close us out, a final word of advice to data providers and third parties looking to move towards open banking.
Oh, the most important advice is I'm going to just absolutely blatantly steal from Jane here. And Jane, I will owe you a Coke later for this. You cannot view this as a compliance exercise. This is a business strategy. You need to be thinking about data in as importantly as you are thinking about data out. You also need to think about data out as a way that is transforming your relationship with your customer. I have seen banks already change the way the customer views the bank more as a platform for the consumer's financial life, where that bank account is the hub of your financial world, whether you are getting the service from the bank or not. We have seen banks that have embraced that dramatically raise their engagement with their customer because the customer views that bank account as the primary account. It's bank account primacy instead of card primacy is really where things are going. So you have to think of this as a business strategy decision, not a compliance exercise.
Yeah, and I think, and we've seen it over the years, the reflexive thought is often like, well, if our customers can share their data, they'll leave us. And to the answer, well, if you're not providing the service, then they should, right? So it is a much bigger, but to John's point, usually it's the institutions that have now really stood up great consumer interfaces. They're learning a lot. Like if you see that 90% of your outbound data is going towards a lending use case, maybe you should look at your lending products, right? So it is absolutely a business imperative. And I think the second ask is to get involved regardless of who you are. Like we have seen small credit unions stand up FDX compliant APIs years ago, right? Because, and I think it was the University of Wisconsin's credit union, guess what? Students use a bunch of fintech apps, right? They didn't sit and say, oh, we fall into the third tranche for compliance, so we've got 5 years to think about this. It's like, no, they just did it. Get involved in FDX, right? This, we are actually standing up a bunch of smaller company councils, both on the data provider side and the third party side. So even if you're very small and you're like, I don't have the time to participate in everything, you can participate in a council and have a group of your peers represent you. So definitely financialdataexchange.org, opening up nominations for small council elections coming soon. But yeah, getting involved versus waiting for the industry or regulators to hand you a to-do list, because by then it's too late.
You can see Jane has embraced the culture. I think the way to look at it, not from a third-party point of view or data provider point of view, but from a consumer point of view, and I think that's what the role is doing. That's what open banking is about. It has to benefit the consumers, the underserved, the underprivileged consumers. It has to provide more products and services to them. It is their personal data. It's not social media data. It has to be safe. It has to be secure. It has to be transferred in a secure manner. It has to be dealt with. It has to be managed in a secure manner. I think that's the way to look at it. It's for the consumer. That's what the C in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is. That's what the C in the Consumer Financial Protection Practice.
So if I may reflect that back, regulation or not, get moving now.
Yep.
Thank you all for an outstanding conversation. It's been an honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Since this recording, a lot has changed. The U.S. elected President Trump, who is not shy about his disdain for onerous regulation. Alongside him is Elon Musk, who has explicitly identified the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as a waste, calling for its deletion. In the first few weeks following Trump's inauguration, the CFPB has been roiled by leadership changes and funding cuts, leading many to question its future, and in turn, the future of its fledgling open banking regulation, Section 1033. It might seem that all these changes and all this uncertainty would alter many of the answers from John, Jane, and Anil. But in fact, most of the points they make remain markedly resilient. Driving interoperability through shared standards still makes sense. Creating common pipes that bind together the entire financial ecosystem still makes sense. And empowering consumers to take control of their data still makes sense. While all three see the value of regulation and stand ready to work with regulators, their ultimate commitment is to those who truly benefit from open banking: consumers. In the end, the aggregators will continue to build the next iteration of American open banking, whatever the future may bring. Thanks for listening to Mr. Open Banking, the podcast that explores the ongoing evolution of open banking and its impact on our lives. Make no mistake, the rise of open banking is going to change financial services forever, and we will be covering that story every step of the way. This is your host, A.L. Savan. Until next time. This episode of Mr. Open Banking was made possible by Ozone API, providers of the only API platform that supports every open banking standard in the world, unlocking the power of open finance. To learn more, visit ozoneapi.com.